The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
Hey guys, this is Tom Schreier, co-founder of ColdOmaha.com. Be sure to check out our Minnesota Timberwolves podcast, Wolves Wired, on the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Join our Wolves insider, Zach Bennett, as well as Tim Fakeless from the Sporting News and the Wolf Among Wolves, and I, as we offer our insights from inside the Minnesota Timberwolves locker room. For many great offerings on the Minnesota Timberwolves and other local sports teams, be sure to follow us on Twitter at ColdOmahaMN, like the Cold Omaha Facebook page, and visit ColdOmaha.com.
Back here again for another episode of Midwest Swing at Midwest Swing Pod on Twitter. This is episode number 10. You are listening to us on the Cold Omaha Podcast Network at Cold Omaha MN. Got some cool stuff going on at coldomaha.com right now. Newly launched website. We've got NFL free agency talk. We've got spring training talk and all kinds of podcasts to fill up your ears. I am joined, as always, by my producer and maestro, Andy Carlson, at Andy Carlson Show on Twitter. Andy, before I ask you how you're doing, is your mood today altered by the signing of Alex Boone for the Minnesota Vikings?
It was kind of expected, and I know that people were bummed about missing out on Assembly, but Alex Boone is going to be just as good at half the price, and you can't really go wrong there.
Yep, absolutely. Pretty excited about that. Pretty exciting day for Vikings fans. This is not a Vikings podcast, so let's get on to our guest of the day. A very, very excited to welcome. Busy here for this guy. It's Eno Saris at Eno Saris on Twitter. His avatar is actually a picture that I snapped. Eno, how we doing?
I'm doing good. It's hard to describe how awesome it is right here right now because it's early morning. The birds are flying overhead. You can hear the crack of a bat in the background, and that's about all you can hear. And it's just really serene and calm, and kind of the calm before the storm, I guess, with the regular season.
Yeah, it sets a really nice ambiance for, you know, the kind of situation around you right now. And again, yeah, like you said, the calm before the storm, games start mattering, and even position battles start getting a little more intense. Guys start getting sent to minor league camp or cut out, right? But this beginning time of the spring is kind of fun. A lot of those prospects that people are following, non-roster type of guys. How many games have you gotten to so far?
About one a day. Yeah, I've averaged about one a day, and I got in last Friday, and I'm leaving next Saturday or this Saturday. So
that's a pretty solid clip.
Yeah, no, I was supposed to go to two yesterday, but decided I would do a fantasy draft instead.
Not surprising to anybody who knows what you're all about. No Fangraphs trip to Arizona this year, so are you kind of on your own, or are you doing stuff for Fangraphs? Are you doing stuff for other places while you're out there?
Just doing my regular stuff. Just talked to Joey Votto and Adam Duvall. Checked in with my man, Anthony Scafani, and talked to him about how awesome his curveball was late last year. Yeah. And how what that means for him. And he said he's not throwing away the changeup, and he's going to bring the changeup back, a couple wrinkles on the changeup, and try and throw it inside to righties a little bit. And he thinks that that four-pitch mix. And, I agree, because the late last season, the last 2 months of the year, he had basically a top 15 strikeout minus walk percentage. And, you know, I think that was based on him really finding that curveball.
Is it wrong for me to be a little bit excited about that Reds rotation this year, even though it's not going to be very high on name value? You know, I think Homer Bailey's working his way back, but Raisel Iglesias has a lot of people buzzing. Are you going to watch that rotation with eager anticipation?
Yeah, I've been all over it. I've written three or four pieces that are watch the, you know, like literally have those titles, like watch the Reds young rotation, like, three young red arms. And, you know, the reason I like it is because this Scafani's, you know, improving and I think could be a real number two. Iglesias has number one stuff and just needs to be able to hold his velocity late in the games. They've been really changing his workout routine. Lamb has a nice rising fastball, got a lot of whiffs with a rising fastball, a really nice change and a really slow, big old curve. And, you know, from a lefty, that kind of package I think can really work if you just gets a tiny bit more command. Finnegan, he says he's working on a curve, but the change looked okay. I think he's a starter. And then I was saying all this to Joey Votto because I haven't even mentioned the old man in the rotation, Homer Bailey, who, if he can get right, he's a good pitcher. But I was saying all this to Joey Votto, and he said, well, have you seen Cody Reed pitch yet? So, you know, I think there is a lot to like in that rotation, and they've really assembled quality and quantity. I mean, they really just went out and got a ton of outs. And I think they're going to be good. I think at least some of them are going to be good. I think they're going to have three or four that are really good.
Do you get the sense that they can turn this around in time to still use or contend again before Joey Votto starts declining?
Yeah, I do think so. I think the parity in this league has gotten to the point where if you're projected to be a 78 to 81 win team, you can get in at any given year. I mean, people don't know this, or people don't seem to talk about this very much, but the error bars on team projections are huge. Mm-hmm. And if you win 10 games more or less than you're projected to win, that's not weird. That's two standard deviations. That's in the normal bell curve. So, you know, as soon as they can get to that point where they're projected to be a 500 win team, you know, what you do is you get in it, you get a little bit lucky early on, and then you go and trade for somebody and you have a different team to finish out the year. And that's how teams are all approaching, I think, the seasons this year, in this sort of game, in the way baseball is now. So, you know, with those kind of arms, Votto, you know, in the middle of your lineup, let's say Billy Hamilton actually does take a little step forward and they find something in Scott Schebler and Jay Bruce bounces back, it could happen as soon as this year. But, you know, more likely it's in the next 2 or 3 years. Maybe it takes a Jay Bruce trade for maybe a young hitter now. But, you know, they also have they have a good sense of how to fill in that offense. And with a park like that that helps the offense, I think focusing on arms is a good idea.
Did they do right by Johnny Cueto in moving him when they did rather than holding on to him and giving him a QO? Do you think they took the right approach there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the guys that they got back for Cueto, like I said, I like Lamb and I like Finnegan. I think those guys are better than, 15th, 16th pick.
Right.
So, and they'd have to wait longer on the 15th, 16th pick. So that's part of it, too. I mean, they only have Votto in his peak for so long, so they really needed to move faster than just trying to collect picks.
Yeah, that's been smart. Do you find yourself being surprised that they've held on to Brandon Phillips, or is it just kind of a byproduct of the fact that he's got a pretty big deal, his age, and all kinds of different factors?
Yeah, from what I heard, as a veteran, a 10-5 guy, he has a lot of control over where he goes.
Right.
And I think he's made some unreasonable, who am I to say they're unreasonable? He's a person with a family, and, you know, but he's made some demands of teams that want to acquire him that have made it hard for the Reds to ship him out.
No, I understand that. Well, that's cool. I was not expecting to go down the foxhole with the Reds, but all great information. So when we chatted last year in Arizona, you're one of a couple people now that I've had on the pod that I've actually met in person. Paul Sporer was on a couple weeks ago. I believe you guys share a podcast, Sleeper in the Bus. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, we sleep in the bus three times a week, and sometimes we add even a little guest pod. That's something we're doing this year.
Yeah, that's
nerdy fantasy podcast.
Well, I've heard rave reviews for it, so keep up the good work there. You know, obviously, so again, I met you guys in Arizona last year, and some of the fun times I had was kind of hearing you talk about your personal life, your upbringing, and that kind of stuff. Where were you born, and where did you grow up?
I was born in Jamaica, and I lived there until I was about 6 years old, five, 6 years old, and it wasn't a place to go to school. My mom really didn't want me to go to school there. So then we were German citizens, so we moved to Germany for a couple of years. And I went to international schools in Germany, in Hamburg. That's where my family's from. But she was in the process of marrying my stepdad, who is a Florida, California guy, and has been in California since the mid-80s. They broke up a few years later. But when they married, we moved to the South, and we lived in different parts of Georgia and different parts of Florida for a long time, actually. And I lived there until about 1994, when I went to boarding school. My mom was always trying to get me to better schools, better schools, better schools. So the best school she could find was in Boston. I went up to Milton Academy in 1994, where I went to school with my coworker, Carson Sestouli, over at Fangraphs. And I went to boarding school for 4 years, and then out to California for college, and then San Francisco, London, New York for 8 years, and now I'm back in California.
So it's like Lupe Fiasco's, was it Go to Sleep in Paris, Wake Up in Tokyo? He kind of wrote that about you. You've kind of been all over the world.
Yeah, it's been fun. You know, the one thing that I miss actually about writing, since the paycheck isn't very large, most of my traveling has been domestic or family based. So I haven't. Mm-hmm. I miss going, being in Europe. I miss traveling to new places, and hopefully, as I get more successful in the future, I'll be able to take some time off and really want to see South America and Australia and Bali and New Zealand. So hopefully my travels take me even further, but it has been fun getting to know different cultures, and I recommend it for anyone, because it, even, you know, traveling within America, you just, it really opens your eyes to what other people are like, what other cultures are like, and what other people value.
How much do you remember about growing up in Jamaica and Germany? Is it kind of like fuzzy memories for you, or do you have fond, vivid memories of those places?
It's pretty vivid, because not only did I live there until I was 5 or 6, those memories are a little bit fuzzy. It's just, I remember going to preschool on the beach, and, you know, I remember the house a little bit and some things here or there. But after that, I went back every summer until I graduated college, basically, for about 10 years. I went every summer to Jamaica with a friend, a different friend each time. And we just had fun and tooled around Jamaica. And it was really interesting to leave a city, most often Atlanta or Boston, and then you go to Jamaica, third world country, and just have fun as a kid again. Where it's just a ton of jumping off cliffs and tooling around the beach and just getting up to no good and seeing reggae shows and stuff. I mean, it was just a lot of fun. And Germany, to me, I visited a few times. So some of those memories run together. But Germany was also, you know, it's good to remind yourself also of where your family came from, and, you know, what happened to sort of create you, what the background was. So when I go to Germany and Jamaica, there's a certain feeling I have as soon as I step on the ground that I don't have as much in America, where it's not a feeling of sort of belonging, because I feel I belong here. I'm American at this point. But in terms of sort of feeling whole again or something, it's sort of just a weird, it's a hard to describe feeling. I feel myself again in a way that I don't necessarily always feel until I step foot in those countries.
No, that's a cool feeling. You mentioned going to school in California. Obviously, Stanford is where you went to college. I know that from our discussions. I think some people may know that too. How'd you end up there? And did anything about the movie Orange County resonate with you, or did it just kind of fall flat? one of my favorite movies. I can't mention Stanford without thinking about it.
Actually, one of my best friends at Stanford was from Irvine. And so I actually spent a lot of time in Orange County, and that movie was definitely something we watched more than once, and something that sort of got passed around that friend group. A lot of those guys ended up moving north to Northern California to hang out with us closer to Stanford. So, but I remember Irvine very well, and I remember that movie. I ended up at Stanford because I got busted in boarding school for drinking.
Damn.
And I had my sights set on Yale, and I was quote unquote supposed to get in early or whatever. And I don't know why I was so fixated on Yale. I think it was just BS name value stuff. I think it was Ivy League, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And I got suspended for 5 days for drinking. And I think it was a bit of a black mark, and there's a heck of a lot of competition coming out of a prep school trying to get into a place like Yale. And I'm so glad. I'm so glad I got busted for drinking. I'm so glad I didn't go to Yale. And Stanford was amazing. The weather was amazing. The people were great. I found I had a couple hiccups there, but I found my place. And I stayed for a master's and just And now I live there again. I actually live in Palo Alto. I thought I wouldn't really come back because it's not a great college town. But as an older person, it's a good place to have your children.
It's funny. There was a major NCAA basketball recruit, and maybe you'll know about him. Reed Travis was choosing between Minnesota and Stanford. So it sounds pretty easy to make that decision, is what you're telling me, between Minnesota and Stanford.
He should just spend a little time there on a nice day.
God. So did you meet your wife there?
Yes, I did. The place that I found for myself where I felt at ease and really liked Stanford the best was a co-op called the Enchanted Broccoli Forest. So I met my wife in the Enchanted Broccoli Forest. And she lived there 1 year, and it was a little bit of dorm fest. And then I moved up to San Francisco with her. Even during my co-term year, I was sort of splitting time between Stanford and San Francisco. And then we've been together since.
And fruits of your marriage, I know you have at least one kid. Is there two? Am I mistaken here?
Yeah, I've got a three-year-old who just won't crap in the potty. It's really frustrating. And then I've got a one-and-a-half-year-old. He's almost one-and-a-half. I've got a 16-month-old who is just gets a lot of ear infections, but he's a really rambunctious little guy, just likes to tear the place up. And even with double ear infections, the doctor was like, whoa, he's been just smiling and just tearing up the house. So
you got to find a way to extract that. You got to find a way to extract that and sell it to grownups like you and me, and you can make millions.
Yeah. Baby energy.
There you go. So baseball, I hear your background story, and then I'm just fascinated by how you landed on baseball. What was your fascination cultivated by, or how did you become this baseball mind that you are right now?
You know, it has a lot to do with my stepfather, actually, and also moving to this country. When I came to this country in 1985 or 1986, sometime in there, I felt like an outsider, and one of the easiest ways to sort of make friends in the neighborhood was collecting baseball cards and, you know, doing the wiffle ball games with where you're sort of mimicking the batting stances and all that. So I don't know if it was like so obvious to me that I was just trying to, you know, make friends in the, you know, but looking back on it, I'm like, yeah, that baseball was a great way for me to make friends. And it's something actually I talked to Chili Davis about this. He's a Jamaican who came to this country, and he said mm-hmm. the exact same thing. You know, I wanted to come to this country and become American, and the easiest way to do that was baseball. So that was part of it. And then I just found out through trading baseball cards that I really enjoyed taking people's best cards for my not-so-good cards.
You were a hustler.
I was a hustler, yeah. And I did a lot of, like, I'll take your Barry Bonds rookie for, you know, this Mark Lemke card because we were in Atlanta and stuff.
Oh,
and I was a shark, and I built up a really nice collection, and I think that set me up for fantasy. And as soon as I got online in college, I wasn't into fantasy when it was paper. I don't think I could have had the patience for that. But in college, when I got online and saw Yahoo Fantasy and started playing it, I was hooked.
When did you get into sabermetrics? Because I know for me it was college, about 2004, 2005. Yeah, I read Moneyball, read the prospectus annuals. And it just kind of hooked me, like that. The game that I had been watching for over 10 years, I was completely misunderstanding. What hooked you for that?
It was a similar thing. I started playing Yahoo Fantasy in 2001, I think, was my first season. Chipper Jones was my first pick. And I think that I had a decent sense. I think because of Chipper Jones, I had a decent sense of what made a good ball player. Because one of the things that I really liked about Chipper and Barry, they were the kind of the guys that I liked the most growing up, was that they took a ton of walks, didn't strike out that much, and had a lot of power, and didn't have a lot of power at all fields. And it's amazing how much I've learned about baseball since. But if you start with that profile, I think you're doing really well. So, you know, that was the basis of it. But then, yeah, I wanted to win my fantasy league. And in order to win my fantasy league, I had to learn more about, you know, how to predict and project baseball players better. And that got me to read, you know, Tango's, the book inside the the game of baseball, and got me addicted to Fangraphs. As soon as I found it, I said, this is amazing.
So where and how did your career in baseball start? Like, where did you dip your toes in the water, whether it was writing or blogging, if you will?
Yeah, what's funny is that I thought coming out of Stanford with a degree in journalism or communications, at least, that I would try and get a job either writing about arts and events or music. That's what I did at Stanford Daily, with arts and events. And I thought maybe that or sports. So I applied to a lot of places, but the job would have required me to leave my girlfriend at the time, my wife now, and travel to a small city somewhere and cover high school sports.
Yeah.
And I'm not the most patient guy. I'm the ambitious guy. I'm not the most patient guy. I just didn't want to do that. So I took a job in publishing, and I think that my idea of a blog back then was like somebody just emoting and just like almost like a personal diary. And I didn't get the impact that would come, especially the game of baseball, from people getting on and doing sort of analysis and doing that on the internet. And I didn't get that until, and this is weird, I think, a little bit, until I moved to London. And I was in London in 2002, 2003, and I realized, oh, God, people are writing this stuff down, and I'm a writer, and I always wanted to write, and I want to write about sports, and so why don't I just start writing?
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote for a site called The Fantasy Lounge, which was a terrible name. Sounds like a strip club.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that.
And so we wrote about every sport, and I wrote so much that they made me a part owner, and I wrote for free. I mean, people talk about this all the time, and it's a thing that people argue about, but I wrote for free. I would just say, if you write for free, and I don't think that it's something that you should not do categorically, if you write for free, you should have some stake in the business. There should be non-monetary or non-obvious monetary reasons for you to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You can even write, I would even write for like Yahoo or ESPN for free for a little bit if they would let me, because that's massive exposure. So there's exposure you can get, and then there's stake in a business you can get, and those things are worth sometimes writing for free. I know that there's other people who are, say, categorically don't do it, but the reality of the internet is that there are a lot of people who have to write for free. So that's one thing I did. I wrote for free for a while, and then I started getting smaller gigs because of Fantasy Lounge writing. I won an award, a Fantasy Sports Writing Award, for a piece I wrote about Kevin Moss. And Kevin Moss was old for his levels. When he was coming up in the minor leagues. So I just wrote a thing about age at level in the minor leagues and how we should have known Kevin Moss was going to be no good, even though there were these chicks in the outfield that would take their tops off every time he hit a home run.
Oh, man.
And so it was like a fun piece with, topless chicks and age at level. And then I made a couple calls at the end where I said, I don't think Matt LaPorta is going to be any good. And Jay Bruce is going to be better because of age level. And I got some attention. And so I moved to New York and decided to be a Mets fan because I wasn't going to be a Yankees fan. And I started writing for a fan ball blog called God Bless Buckner. And that transitioned to an SBN blog called Amazing Avenue. And Fangraphs gave me a part-time gig at first, and then Jody Carey hired me to write at Bloomberg Sports for a while. And all I did was say yes, yes, yes to any opportunity, always yes, and always try harder. My wife, amazing that she stayed with me, because she was a little annoyed that almost every night or every other night that we came home and we were hanging out, I would have to do some writing. So it's amazing that she was so supportive. But I just said yes, 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 work, 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 and sometimes did things that I wasn't going to get paid for because it made sense. And one glorious day, as I had just taken a job to work for MLB.com as an editor, Fangraphs David Appelman called me and offered me a full-time job. I think that was 5 years ago, basically. And that was one of the happiest days of my life, honestly, because it was a full-time job writing about sports, and it has allowed me to do so many great things then.
Yeah, that's incredible. That was actually what I was going to ask next, was the, you know, the list of places that you've been, quite a rap sheet, and it's great to hear, you know, a unique perspective as far as writing for free and writing to get paid. I've kind of tried to do that yes, yes, yes thing too, and I've had the similar support system for my better half as well. So I can relate to some of those things, and it's definitely nice to have somebody in your corner, even if they are a little frustrated at times, to be able to say, you know, yep, forge on, I got you here, you know, you got support, because it's really hard to do those things in a vacuum without feeling some kind of support behind you.
Yeah.
So you are, I believe, the editor-in-chief, or you're the number one guy at Rotographs, and so de facto my boss there, so I guess I have to tread lightly here. But I guess, so when it came to fantasy writing, was it just something you had an aptitude for, you know, or was it a niche that you thought that you could, you know, uniquely attack, or did things just kind of fall into place for you?
No, I mean, it, David Appleman started Fangraphs because he wanted to win his fantasy league. And I started reading Fangraphs because I wanted to read my fantasy league. So, yeah, it's always been, I love playing fantasy, and attacking baseball from this sort of analytical perspective has always been because I've wanted to win my fantasy league. It's changed a little bit since, because I've started talking to players more. And the more that I talk to players, the more I see their perspective and have become fascinated with a part of the game that I was terrible at. I was a really, really bad baseball player. Mm. And so, you know, being able to talk to guys who are really good at it about what they do to be good and the little things they do, the little adjustments they do. Sometimes they aren't predictive, and sometimes they aren't something that I can necessarily use to win my fantasy league. And yet I'm so deep into baseball now that I just love talking to people about that sort of thing.
How many leagues are you doing this year?
Yeah, I'm always trying to cut it down. This year I just don't even want to count them, but I know it's at least 12.
And what's your record?
You know, the way I see it, especially because I've been playing against part of the tougher and tougher opponents as I've taken these different leagues on, the way I see it, you know, talent gets you into the top third, and then luck takes you the rest of the way. So I'm more happy that, you know, about 60 to 70% of my league, I'm in the top third. And wins, I usually win, I would say, 2 to 5 a year. I mean, I've had some really good years where I won almost a third of my league and just felt really great. But and then some years where I only win 2. But there's always a win. And I usually do a little bit better in the leagues that have skin in the game. So that's a kind of funny side thing where if I put some money down, I'm definitely a little more attentive.
Have you been in more than 12 leagues in previous years, or like a lot more than that?
Yeah, I hit a peak of about 15.
Wow. Yeah, I've had 8. I had 8 one year, and that was difficult to keep up with. So I definitely have mad respect for that.
Oh, it's too much. Even with weekly lineups, when I was at 15, it would take me an hour, hour and a half to set lineups every night. And that's just ridiculous. I mean, that just takes time away from writing and working and sleeping and being.
All important things. You just did your AL-only labor draft in Arizona, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
And how did that go for you? I mean, I think it's one of the industry drafts that it garners a lot of attention. It's like Tout Wars and obviously the NL League too. What was your experience? How did it go for you this year compared to, you know, I know you did the draft last year. Paul Sporer came and helped you out. So I know you've been in it for at least a couple years now, but did you have a good experience in the draft this year?
I think I've been like 10th, 4th, and 11th. So this is my year. I'm the Giants every other year. I made some mistakes. I wrote it up on Rotographs if anybody's interested in seeing. I made some mistakes. I set the market on catchers. I threw Matt Wieters too early. So
yeah,
I
was like $17 or something like that.
Yeah, and like then all the other catchers were $15, and I would have taken any of the other catchers for $15. So that didn't make me happy. But it was just $2. And, you know, if anybody tells you that they got everybody they exactly wanted, the price they wanted, then they're lying. So,
yes, they are.
And so I have a super high-risk pitching staff, but I always do. And this one has Tanaka and Smiley at the top. And, you know, I know there's a lot of health risk there, but I feel like there's a decent amount of health risk to everybody else. And I took Stroman as my ace last year, and there seems to be no health risk. And then, you know, pop goes the ACL. So I feel like one thing I'd like to avoid is I hate dollar players. And $1 players in American League only are not starters. They're backup players that may get a role or may not, and they just seem like really bad bets. So I don't have any dollar players. I don't have any top five players either, but Todd Frazier is my stud. It seems just fine to me. You know, I'm okay with that. Todd Frazier and Rougned Odor are my studs, and, you know, I think I'm going to get, between the two of them, I think I'm going to get 45 homers and, you know, 30 steals.
Yeah, I think Frazier is going to be a really nice get for the White Sox. You know, we were talking about the Reds earlier and how they kind of unloaded, but I think that the White Sox are in that thing where they kind of have to make their move or get out of the game in terms of trying to contend. So I really like Frazier. Did you get, was it you that got John Ryan Murphy for your second catcher?
Yeah, and it seems to me that everybody in Minnesota must know that Kurt Suzuki's a bomb.
He's really bad, but honestly, it's like Terry Ryan and Paul Molitor are going to be the last ones to know.
Well, I know, but I think that at some point, JR's got the bat, and at some point, they're going to see that bat and just want to get in the lineup more often. So I paid $5 for him, and that's fine if he only gets like 300 plate appearances, or, you know, just has like basically backup catcher work. I think that's worth about $5, but I really think that he's going to hit so well that they, you know, Kurt Suzuki can handle whatever pitcher they think needs a little bit more help behind the plate. And then JR is going to catch all the guys, the veterans that don't need as much help.
What did you think of that swap? Aaron Hicks is going to be a fourth outfielder, but will probably play quite a bit considering, you know, the relative age of some of the guys in that Yankees outfield and just the rest of that team combined. You know, they'll cycle some guys through DH and all that. Do you like the trade for the Twins? Do you like it for the Yankees? I still think there's something in there with Hicks that will unlock, and he could be the, you know, the post-hype Carlos Gomez 2.0, but, you know, that light bulb is starting to flicker a lot more for other people than me, of course. But did you think the Twins came out on top, or did the Yankees come out on top there?
Yeah, you know, I think it's actually a decent trade for both. I mean, the Yanks, what they needed was youth. They needed some upside in the outfield. They needed somebody when Carlos Beltran's legs give out. So, you know, I think they needed – that's what they needed. I think the Twins needed a catcher more than, you know, because Pinsel wasn't really working out as a catcher. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think Suzuki doesn't really offer much, at least offensive upside. And I think they needed to spread things around. And they have – the Twins have Max Kepler, who I love, especially as a German.
Definitely.
And Byron Buxton. And they even have other pieces. If Danny Santana can get it back together again, he can
be a good
outfielder. Eddie Rosario is looking better than I thought he would. So, and Sano's going to be an outfielder this year. I mean, they've got a decent amount of youth and upside in the outfield, so they didn't necessarily need Hicks. I think that Hicks can do what he did last year. I don't think there's a lot left beyond that, but I believe in what he did last year. And I think it's because he's a patient guy with tools, and last year he finally found out how to be aggressive in the zone. And I think if you look at zone swing rates and what he did inside the zone, that he finally paired sort of patience outside the zone with aggressiveness inside the zone, which is a winning combo. So I think, you know, his contact issues will keep him from being a plus-plus batting average, plus-plus OBP guy, but he's going to have a decent on-base percentage. He's going to steal a couple bags. He's going to have some power. And I think he'll play his way to 400 plate appearances at least this year with the Yankees because the age problems that they have the rest of the outfield.
Yeah, I think he's the kind of guy that his ceiling is he could hit 250 and still have a good enough on-base percentage to hit at the top of your order. He started driving the ball more, too. I don't know that it shows up definitely in his hard hit rate, but louder contact, driving the baseball, not necessarily maybe more frequently, but when he did, you know, it was more productive. And I think, you know, he is going to be a guy that probably will hit lefties much better than righties for his career. But those guys have use, and as long as he's athletic enough to handle center, he can carve out a really nice long career. If not in New York, he'll bounce around. I mean, Danny Valencia has bounced around as a lefty masher, and finally found footing in your backyard in Oakland. So it's fun to see how former Twins kind of bounce around like that. One thing I wanted to ask you about is something I've contributed to, is how massive of an undertaking is Fangraphs Plus for you every single fall or winter too, I guess?
A little more help this year. Paul Spohr did some editing with me, and I transferred. We made it free this year. So, if you go onto Fangraphs and see those player caps, you'll see it for free. And we moved the research pieces that we usually make. We moved those over to the Hardball Times, so Paul Swiden helped me edit those. So with the help, it was a little bit easier this year, but still, it's 1,250 player caps. Little capsules about the players, little blurbs about the players that end up being about 400 to 500 words. So if you do the math, I'm not going to do it. it's a lot of words.
Yeah,
it's a lot of work.
I enjoy the day that I get the email from PayPal saying that I got paid for it. I think that's my favorite. My favorite part of it is,
well, it's kind of fun. It's like even as a writer doing them, it's basically, the cap is born of work for the upcoming fantasy season. I mean, that's all you're doing, is you look at these players and you say, what are they going to do this year? Are they going to be useful to me in a fantasy league? And, what stats are key and what should we be looking for? So, that sort of work is something that anybody who's in fantasy loves to do, I think.
Yeah, for us, it's kind of a labor of love. We're already going to research guys that we want to roster or not roster, or guys that we're intrigued by. And then there's the angle of guys that you watch play all season. So if I have, 40 caps, 25 might be Twins, 5 might be guys that I watched in the Central, and then 10 guys might be total wild cards, like Brad Brock of the Orioles. But it's fun to change it up and do all those different things. And, I think it's a fun project. Now, you mentioned that they made them free this year. Did that kind of go in conjunction with the Fangraphs subscription that they just rolled out?
Yeah, Fangraphs membership, it's sort of the NPR model where I think we'll see how much of it grows into an NPR model, but there might be some twists on it in the future. But for now, it's basically, what we found was a lot of people were giving money were paying for Fangraphs Plus and weren't even playing fantasy. So they were just basically donating to the, and there were a lot of comments on the pieces that said, I'm just getting this because I love Fangraphs so much. So we decided that we'd just separate the two and have the player caps be free and allow people to enjoy those for free. And if they wanted to donate, just donate.
That's actually, I like that model. That's I think has a good chance to really turn out well. And, there's a good grassroots movement that follows Fangraphs very, very staunchly. And I enjoy that, because then, you're going to have people with, returning to your stuff. Now, the one thing I want to touch on here about podcasting too, we'd mentioned The Sleeper and the Bust. I did that show. I went on with Mike Podhorzer a couple times. How has that show evolved to now where it's you and Paul Spohr, and I think Jason Collette joins you guys too?
No disrespect to the people who've come before. I've enjoyed working with all of them, but I really think that we're hitting our peak and hitting our stride really well. One of the things I really enjoy about Paul is he's a showmaster, but he also, and that's something that the other guys were as well. I've worked with Mike Podhorzer before, and what Paul does a little bit more even is challenge me and have his own spin on certain players and allow us to have some spirited exchanges. And he also has the energy to go and get some guests, podcasters and go out there and add to it. So, and then Collette is just a funny guy with a wealth of experience and a great sort of look into baseball. And I think people really enjoy his Sunday episode too. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun. We've gotten better at the things that you do in podcasting in terms of production quality. And, now we have our good mics and we're a little bit better at segmenting and planning out each episode and stuff like that. So I think we've grown as broadcasters ourselves.
Yeah, I can certainly relate to the progression and trying to learn how to stagger things out so you don't have 3 hours worth of material and 1 hour to get through it. Or worse yet, the opposite, where you're trying to stretch something really thin. So you're not strictly a Rotographs guy. You're obviously a main page Fangraphs guy too. The favorite thing that I, from my viewpoint, that you do is the pieces on grips. You do a lot of fun things and obviously, again, a must read over there. But what was your fascination with grips and how did you get into writing about those on a regular basis?
Yeah, it's funny. I was talking to Sean Doolittle, who I love talking to, and I was talking to him about the fact that he's a one-pitch pitcher. That was exactly the conversation we were having. And he said, well, you know, come on. I'm trying. I'm learning the slider, and I'm thinking about throwing the split finger. And I said, oh, that's interesting. How do you hold that split finger? So he was showing it to me. He's like, really, if you're interested in this sort of stuff, you should talk to Dan Straley. And I said, okay, Dan Straley. And so Doolittle brought me over to Dan Straley and said, Dan, tell him about the changeup. So apparently Dan Straley, in the effort to learn a changeup, tried 17 different changeup grips.
Whoa.
in the minor leagues for Oakland. And I just asked him to show me all 17.
That's amazing.
I don't know if you remembered all 17, but we did get like 11 or 12 grips in a row. So he just showed me each of the variations. We even filmed it. And so then I just wrote a story about what it's like to be a pitcher coming up in the A's organization, trying to learn a changeup, what the development process is like, what it was like. He came from a small town where they didn't really have a lot of instruction, baseball instruction, and what it was like to go to a big college that where he got some instruction there. How much that changed in the minor leagues. But he just told me about stuff like, you know, kangaroo court fines for not throwing enough changeups. He sometimes would come to the end of the start and realize he hadn't thrown the requisite number of changeups, so he'd just throw 5 changeups in a row. And just stuff like that. And then peppered in between all the stuff about instruction and development were these pictures of these different changeup grips. And little comments from him like, well, I had this one for a week, but it didn't work out. And that one just did really well. And one of the few times I've gotten feedback from Dave Cameron, he was like, hey, people seem to really like this.
Well, that's good. Yeah, boss man reach out to you and tell you that.
Yeah. So now I am searching for it to be more meaningful a little bit and use it when it is meaningful and not necessarily just ask every pitcher about it. So I slowed down a little bit on the grips, but you know, at the end of last season, beginning of this season, I had like Odorsama Despaña has a crazy weird knuckle curve grip where he's actually got the fingers overlaid on top of each other. And just this week I did a piece with Kyle Hendricks with 2 changeups. So just showing how little difference there was between the grips on the 2 changeups. It's just a little movement of the seam, how that changes, that the changeup goes in one direction when he holds it one way, and it goes in the other direction when he holds it another way. So I thought that was super interesting. So it's, you know, as Dave Rigetti once told me, it's the last thing that touches the ball. You know, your hand touches the seam, that's the last thing that happens before the ball leaves and becomes a pitch. So it is important, and it, you know, using those seams and using the dynamics of the ball lead to different movements and are fascinating. I think a lot of pitchers spend a lot of time in bullpens. You know, here's my knuckle grip. What was your knuckle grip look like? You know, so, you know, it's definitely something that anybody who's played baseball has tinkered around with.
Now, do you do stuff with the A's and the Giants? Am I reading into that correctly?
Well, I live in the Bay Area, and I mostly spend my time in the visitors' locker room. So whoever comes to town, I go interview the guys in the visitors. I do go to the home locker room. I'm in the home clubhouse as well. But I don't have the same relationships with the Giants and A's as the beat writers do. And they do a great job building those relationships and getting really interesting things out of those players. So I come in. I have a couple friendships. I love talking to Madison Bumgarner. You know, I really enjoy talking to Sam Fold. There's a couple guys that I just always just go over to their locker and sort of, you know, what's going on? What are you thinking about? Sean Doolittle's one of those guys. And otherwise, I don't sort of approach these things as a beat writer. So I'm not there to find out, you know, who's starting today and who's mad at whom and what's going on with the leadoff position or anything. So I'm in there mostly when someone has done something noteworthy and changed their strategy. You know, go talk to Josh Reddick when all of a sudden he's not, you know, not swinging at anything on the outside part of the plate, and ask him about, you know, where he got that idea and what it's doing for him at the plate.
Yeah, I like to hear that you kind of got your go-to guys here in Minnesota. Phil Hughes is kind of that guy for me, but then also I like talking to Trevor May. His transition to the bullpen has been fascinating. Obviously, pretty good starter last year, but really his stuff started popping when he went to the bullpen. So it's cool to hear that the guys have their go-to guys. As far as guys that you've liked talking to, are there? Do you have a list of guys that are like the most fascinating, whether it's home guys or maybe guys that when they come to town, you know, you're really excited to go out and talk to them, you know, if they're visiting in the visiting clubhouse, you know, at either AT&T or at O.co?
Well, there's an easy list of two that are such great players that everybody will read the piece that I write. And they're such great minds that not only do they have great answers for me about my questions, usually by the end of the interview, they have questions for me.
I bet I know who one of them is.
Joey Votto, I just talked to him. And the other is Zach Greinke. Other is Zach Greinke. And then today, actually, I told Joey Votto that Zach Greinke was like him. And he's like, I could see that. And, you know, Zach Greinke will pull me aside at the end of an interview and say, okay, you're done with your stuff. Well, what about this? So those are my favorites. But, you know, they're sabermetrically inclined. They think about the game in the way that a lot of fantasy players do, front office guys do. They think about things in terms of big sample things and big trends, and they're not as worried about, you know, talking to me about what Giancarlo Stanton did against them the last at bat or whatever. They're more about, you know, trends and stuff. So that's really interesting. I do love talking to them, but I also have guys on the other side, which, you know, Stephen Vogt and Madison Bumgarner to me represent another kind of player who know a lot about their craft, think really hard, have had to adjust and make adjustments and in order to become better players. But they are more old school. And they, you know, Stephen Vogt calls me stat boy. And Madison Bumgarner kind of raises an eyebrow and looks at me and is like, what you got? But I'd really enjoy getting a different sort of perspective. And oftentimes they are right in their own way, and they have their own different words they use and the different ways they sort of put it forth. But they have a lot to say, and I enjoy talking to them as well. Tim Hudson was the same way. Tim Hudson was amazing. Every time I could talk to Tim Hudson, Tim Hudson and Madison Bumgarner used to sit right next to each other. And that was one of my favorite places in the world, because I would get one of them going, and then they would start yelling at each other, and they would start disagreeing with each other, and I would just be there with a recorder on and be like, yes, yes.
Just kind of goading them on to keep on going?
Yeah. So
we had a whole
exchange about preparing for games. I don't think I've even written about it, but I was trying to talk to Madison about preparing for games. He's like, oh, I don't like to get too worked up about what's going to happen in the game, because, you know, I don't want to get too stuck in one game plan. You know, I want to be reactive. I want to see what's going on. And Tim Hudson goes, don't ask a young guy about prepping for the game. He just throws his glove out there and throws 94, man. That's his plan for the game.
Sounds like Roger Clemens, kind of.
He's like, talk to him again when he's 40, like me. Then he'll have a game plan.
I love hearing that, like the evolution of guys going from throwers to pitchers. Now, that's not to downplay what Bumgarner does, because he's a magician out there. But there are
there's a little bit more to him, I think, even he'll admit to me sometimes. So, because I heard from somebody else that he does do some game planning. So it's all a definition of what's a lot and what, you know, what's a little. So.
Were you psyched to see Zach Greinke stay in the NL West then, so you could still have pretty regular
access? Oh, yeah, but I wanted, you know, the Giants were in on him. I wanted them to sign the Giants so bad. Yeah. If I could have had Zach Greinke and Dazen Bumgarner every day, day I go into San Francisco camp, or into AT&T, that would have been just amazing.
They really addressed that rotation a lot in San Francisco. There, are you expecting big things from that Giants rotation?
I'm a little worried that I love Cueto's deception. I love the wiggles. I love the quick pitches and all that stuff. I love it. But there's something about it that makes me wonder if he's going to struggle to stay healthy and struggle with command at times, because it's just a lot of moving parts. It's just a crazy delivery. It's not the same thing over and over again. That seems to be, Mass Mungar is the same thing over and over again. That's why it's great command, I think. So, Cueto worries me a little bit more. Samardzija has, good velocity and swinging this stuff. And I think with a park that keeps the homers in, he can be more aggressive in the zone. Mm-hmm. He did some weird stuff with the cutter last year that I think he'll probably just step off of the cutter a little bit. And he'll be a lot better this year. I mean, he led the league last year in hits allowed and, runs allowed or something. So, that was an unfortunate year. But at the same time, he still got the strikeout. So I have a little bit more hope for Samardzija, I think.
What's your level of excitement for having Chris Coughlin with the A's?
I hope that he's not so mind over. There's been some great pieces with David Lorillo and even Mike Petriello on the StatCast podcast had some good stuff with them. So, but I think I might treat him like a Sam Bold situation where I just make friends with him and just get his thoughts on the game and use that to inspire other pieces and inspire me to talk to other people about what he said. So
yeah,
it's always nice when a heady player comes to town.
Yeah, it's good to have a jump off point. It doesn't necessarily have to be something you can use, obviously, where it's everything he gives you write down and use, but the inspiration I think is big too. You mentioned Samardzija. When I look at the White Sox rotation last year, they led the American League in innings and WAR, and obviously Samardzija is a big loss for them. Do you hold any hope for Matt Latos picking up any of the slack for them?
Yeah, Latos is an interesting guy.
He really is.
He makes a lot of people angry, and a lot of people say he's a total bum. Yeah, I think he was very injured last year. A lot of people also say he doesn't have a good head on his shoulders, and that may be true, but at the same time, when I engaged him on baseball topics, because I talked to him about, he throws this weird pitch he calls the critter, that's basically a knuckle change. He flicks the ball with his finger as he releases it. It's a ridiculous thing. If you want to take a look at Google the critter, it's a very weird thing. But when that was happening, we had the whole bullpen around laughing about it. He had the bullpen coach in there. The bullpen coach was like, the critter. Don't know where it's been. Don't know where it's going. And they had a tagline and everything. So I think the head case stuff is a little bit overblown. I mean, a lot of these guys are rip it and rip it guys. It's okay. Not everybody needs to be super heady. I think for him, the biggest question is health. I think if he's healthy, he's going to be good. And it's hard to know if he's healthy. And it's hard to, I mean, I'm not a doctor, and I just would say that he didn't look healthy last year. And if he's healthy this year, then they're good to go. But yeah, the top three, I really like Rodon. And if Rodon's, the changeup looks pretty good, he just can't command it that well. If he just takes a little step forward, that whole package is going to click. And all of a sudden they're going to have three, 1-2 types at the top of their rotation. And they've did a lot of work on the lineup. And the lineup doesn't really have as many holes as it used to. It doesn't really have any holes. And they, by signing guys, they pushed other guys into depth roles, and they've really improved their depth. So, to me, the White Sox are going to be a very intriguing team this year. I think the White Sox Twins are going to battle it out at the top of that division.
Yeah, I think that it's going to be a fascinating division. I did a Periscope chat before I jumped down with you here. And, besides behind the plate, where I'm not really thrilled about them, they moved on from Tyler Flowers, which, in a lot of ways, is addition by subtraction. But they'll have some interesting things going on back there. I thought they would have been a good fit for Jared Saltalamacchia, rather than Detroit. Again, not really a difference maker back there, but just a guy that they could have thrown back there. But they did make a lot of moves. in a division that's going to be hotly contested. I did want to ask you too. You're one of the more recent inductees into the BBWAA. Not obviously not the most recent, but what did it mean to you to be inducted into that organization?
It means everything. I get access without having to pitch my pieces, and if I had to pitch my pieces, you know, in a canned pitch to a PR guy who's going to pass it on to a player, they just wouldn't fly. I mean, there's no way that a PR guy is going to say, hey, you know, this guy wants to talk to you about your pitch grips or whatever. Then, you know, the pitch is going to be a who, where, what, you know. But just getting in front of these guys and hitting them up in a casual conversation about their mechanics and about what they do to get so good, that's a lot easier. And without the card and without the access that the card provides, I wouldn't be able to do what I do at all.
Yeah, it's definitely a goal for me in the future, and I'd be just psyched to have that kind of access. But you know what? Even just having daily access is a huge jump to 2013 was the first year I had my card, and that card means a lot. Just a local card, you know, where you get in every game, no questions asked.
For the same reason, because you don't have to ask Phil Hughes to talk to you. You just go over and you say, hey, what's up, Phil?
Right, and it's the instant credibility that you belong there rather than a daily pass that looks a little more obscure and a little more temporary. Okay, so you obviously you mentioned being a Mets fan. How geeked are you for that pitching staff who now seems to be on the cusp of getting, I believe, Zach Wheeler back here for hopefully at some point this season? Are you just thrilled about the prospect of having those five guys plus Bartolo Colon kind of jockeying for position there?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a real testament to the development process the Mets have undergone and the pitching development they can do in the minor leagues. I mean, just look at Jacob DeGrom. He learned his curveball from Frank Viola, who's a minor league instructor there. He learned a slider from Dan Worthen, who's the major league pitching coach. And he learned his changeup from Johan Santana. And he started with great command of a 94-plus mile-an-hour fastball. I mean, literally, that's all he had. He was a closer and a shortstop at Stetson University. I don't even know if it's a university. And he was a long shot, and they just worked at him, and he became a Frankenstein pitcher, where they just put together the pieces, and this is what they got. And Harvey learned a slider from Dan Worthen, and all these guys, you know, take a big leap when they get to work with Dan Worthen because he's such a great pitching coach. So, you know, they drafted well, and some of those guys are Omar Minaya guys. That's fine. That's what happens with the cycles in front offices. He deserves some credit for finding some guys. But at the same time, a lot of those guys are developed by the guys that are put in place now to coach them. And so I have hope that they can sort of continue that and find some new arms. I know they traded away some arms last year to be competitive, but I have hope that they can continue to find guys, develop well.
I hear you talk about the Worthen slider all the time. For someone who doesn't know what that is, best explain it.
He says that instead of trying to manipulate the ball, you basically just throw a fastball and then you sort of flick your fingers at the end. And so the point is to make the ball, I guess, you know, some people would say it's a cutter, and I asked him, is it a cutter? And he said, I don't think it's a cutter because if you move your thumb around on the bottom, you get different varying degrees of depth. So it's a little bit somewhere between a cutter and a slider. But the point is to try and put less stress on your arm by not trying to manipulate the ball and just throw that sort of flick it at the end with your fingers instead of doing anything with your wrist. That's how he described it to me. So they're usually the hardest sliders in the league. I mean, Harvey and DeGrom have, you know, top 10 hard sliders. Familia learned out of the same thing, and his is a top hard slider. So they're usually, instead of, you know, being 6 to 8 miles an hour slower, they're usually, you know, 2 to 4 miles an hour slower than the fastball, and they come in just with a little bit of different depth on it. I think that at least weak contact has a little bit more than whiff, but it also screws with people's timing and can be a really effective pitch.
Of the five guys that they have pegged to kind of be their moving forward guys, which one would you be most apt to sign to a long-term deal?
I think signing pitchers to long-term deals is a bad idea. But
maybe 5-year deal. You know, let's just say they all had the same level of control, and you were going to keep a guy for 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
Who would be the one you would like the most for that kind of deal?
The thing, DeGrom and Harvey have both had Tommy John, and mm-hmm. the second Tommy John is just so much risk. At the same time, Noah Syndergaard, he's had forearm tightness in the minor leagues.
Right.
And he throws maybe the hardest out of all of them. So, in a way, I think I would take DeGrom because I love the command, and I think a repeatable delivery with command is the I think his natural command is the best. Harvey will fill up the zone with hard stuff because his stuff is unhittable, but I don't think he has the same natural command as DeGrom. So I'd put my money on DeGrom just because I like his command so much.
Yeah, I like that. I think I'd go with Syndergaard, but you know that is just due to age and dominance. But you know it is terrifying forearm tightness, velocity, that mix of things that can provide the perfect storm. And, you know, sometimes those guys stay healthy, sometimes they don't. Before I let you go here, I wanted to touch on some of your passions outside the game. One thing you tweet about quite frequently that I find I equally love and hate is the sandwiches that you're eating at the given time. And the hate only comes from the fact that I'm not also eating that sandwich at that same time. but between sandwiches and beer, how do you not weigh 300 pounds, first and foremost? And what other things do you like outside of the game of baseball?
Well, I guess my secret is I don't do much other than sandwiches and beer. So I don't drink any sodas. I don't drink any juices. I drink water or beer. That's all I drink.
That's smart.
And when I eat a sandwich, there are no chips next to it. So I just I try to focus on exactly what I like. In fact, my New Year's resolution this year was, one, don't finish your kids' plates when they don't eat the rest of their food. Mm-hmm. And two, pour out that beer if you don't like it. Because there's not enough calories. Just there's no reason to do bad calories. So that's what I've been my approach. Also, I started pretty skinny. I am a little fatter than I used to be. So I play basketball too. That's the other thing I do to try to keep the pounds off. But beer and sandwiches are too good for me to just swear them off.
I can't let you go without letting you talk about beer graphs. Where are you at with that, and have you been excited about how that's grown?
Yeah, you know, beer graphs was the idea was basically just if we have numbers on beer, then can we treat it like baseball and have a fan graph of beer? And I would say I want so much more for it, and I have hopes for it still, and I think there's going to be more and more that, you know, as we start to collect information from the internet, we can start to classify beers by taste profiles and by hop profiles. And then I think I could really help people say, you know what, I really like fruity IPAs. And instead of just sorting, right now you can sort for IPAs and Minnesota, and you can say which are the best IPAs in Minnesota, and you can pull that up pretty easily. But I think it'd be amazing if you could throw on top of that, well, I really like piney, dank IPAs. And get a different list. And I love fruity IPAs. I love light IPAs, you know. So I think all that's in the future, and really excited for it.
Well, I want to thank you for taking time out of your very, very busy schedule. Where can people find not only your tweets, but all the writing and all the different things you're doing, whether it's video, podcast? Where's all your stuff at right now?
Well, you can find Sleeper in the Bus on iTunes. And we have a very rabid following that have given us a 5-star rating on the
nice.
On the 300 rate on 300 ratings. So I love my listeners. You can find me on Twitter at ENOSARRIS, and I write on Fangraphs for the most part and Rotographs. And then I do a little gig with ESPN Insider once a week. That pretty much covers most of it.
All right, well, again, thank you so much for joining us. This has been episode 10 of Midwest Swing. As Eno mentioned, you can find Sleeper in the Bus on iTunes. You can also find us on Swing on iTunes or on coldomaha.com. This has been episode number 10 on the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Thanks for joining us, and see you all next week.
It's Sam Ekstrom, and I'm here to tell you that I'm not perfect. I have vices. Most of us do. Maybe you're like Peyton Manning and you enjoy Budweiser. Maybe you can't resist Dairy Queen blizzards. Maybe you're into e-cigs. Hey, no judgment. I enjoy betting on sports. And if you also enjoy betting on sports for a little entertainment, you'll love the podcast featuring yours truly, Sam Ekstrom, along with Sam Verhulst, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network, available on iTunes and on Stitcher. Don't dread the spread. Turn your nickels into dimes.
Hey guys, this is Tom Schreier, co-founder of ColdOmaha.com. Thank you for listening to the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes and leave us a comment and a rating. Also, don't forget to check out ColdOmaha.com to see all of our podcasts and read articles about your favorite teams in the Twin Cities. If you have any suggestions or comments on anything related to Cold Omaha, email us at editors@ColdOmaha.com or follow us on Twitter at ColdOmahaMN.
The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.